Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the New Books in Science and Technology and Society, a podcast for the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Chad Vlasic. Today, we'll be talking to Dan Chard and Sigrid Smalzer about their book that they edited called Science for the People, Documents from America's Movement of Radical Scientists. In a time where the politics of science have only intensified, this is a very appropriate addition to have. This book is indeed an edited volume featuring original documents from the movement of radical scientists and activists from 1969 to 1989, and also includes some recently declassified FBI files on the group, which hopefully we'll be talking about. Science for the People dealt with a number of issues from agriculture, as we'll hear, and genetic screenings, ideology and the sciences more broadly, just to name a very select few. In addition, the movement dealt with the problems of military and corporate funding of science and other structural aspects of labor in science, such as various biases and restrictions against women and people of color. Sigrid and the other editors also discuss how this group fits in with the history and work of STS, since not only was there overlap in membership, if you will, their analytic and critical views of the relationship between science and society is as relevant as ever for the field. Let us begin by welcoming Sigrid and Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
Great to have you here. So just to get us started, why don't you just say a little bit about yourselves and about how you became interested in this issue of science and politics?
Thanks. So I went to high school in the 1980s, and by that point, I was already identifying very strongly as an environmentalist. I thought I wanted to go into the environmental sciences in college so that I could pursue that interest. But I quickly realized that my skills and my interests lay more in the area of the kind of ideas about science than in actual lab work. And I found a program, I was sitting at Wesleyan University, I found a program called Science and Society. And that allowed me to think about the issues that I was interested in, but in social context and political context. And so I combined that with a major in East Asian studies and developed this area of research in the history of science in socialist and post-socialist China. And that's been the main focus of my research ever since. And Science for the People, I can say a little later maybe about how I ended up on this road. But that actually emerged out of the work I was already doing on China.
Yeah, and I don't have much of a background in science. I'm a historian, and I don't consider myself a historian of science, although maybe I am now after editing this book. But I was recruited onto this by Sigrid, and maybe during the interview she'll talk more about how her interest in this specific book came about. I have a background. I study post-World War II U.S. social movements and politics, and I have, like Sigrid, a background in different forms of left-wing or radical social movements. And I was really interested in the Science for the People movement when Sigrid introduced them to me, because I study movements of this period and I never heard of this group before. And they've been, once I started looking at the archives and talking to some of the members there was a conference that Sigrid helped organize in 2014, right? Mm-hmm. At UMass, which had all these former members, and I started interviewing and speaking with them, and these people were really involved in most of the major movements of the U.S. left or new left during the late the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. So from the women's movement and anti-war to supporting the Black Panthers and the environmental movement. So I'm really happy to have helped bring the writings of these people to a new audience.
Great, thank you. So in terms of getting started on this project then, did it start with the archive or how did it come about?
So actually, and I always feel like it's good politics to bring in this piece of it, especially for women academics. When I got pregnant with my first baby, I needed a project that I didn't have to go to China to do my research for. So I started looking around and I thought I would write about Americans who went to China in the early 70s. And what they thought of science as it was practiced in socialist China. And there was a book that had been on my shelf since forever, but I had never really known where it had come from. It was authored by these folks called Science for the People, and it was a report of their trip to China in 1973, published in 1974, called China, Science Walks on Two Legs. Very celebratory account of what they had seen about how science could work in a non-capitalist context, you know, in a revolutionary political context. And so I was interested in kind of following up on that. I saw, you know, what the list of the delegates who had gone, and I looked some of them up. I was able to make contact with some of them and start interviewing some of them and kind of wrote up the findings. And in the process, I ended up kind of, as Dan was saying, you know, once you get to know these folks, it's really exciting. And so, you know, their interest was kind of what drew me to my interest in the history of science in socialist China as well. And even though, you know, I tend to have a more critical perspective, time has gone by and, you know, I maybe know more about Chinese history than they knew at the time. And so my lens is more critical. I shared with them an excitement and an enthusiasm for learning from socialist China about, you know, or just expanding our ideas about the way that science and society can interact. So after talking to them for a while, one of them said, well, why don't you get us back together one last time, you know, a little reunion of the Science for the People. We haven't done that. And, you know, we should do it. We're all getting old and this kind of thing. And so I thought, oh, well, UMass would be a good place to have this because it's, you know, accessible both to Boston and New York. And there's still a lot of Science for the People in those two areas. And I threw the invitation open, and so many people said yes that before we knew it, we were applying for National Science Foundation funding for it. Everybody seemed to want to co-sponsor it. Everybody was really excited about it. So we held this big conference in 2014 here. It was called Science for the People, the 1970s and Today. And about 60 people were ended up presenting. About 200 people ended up attending. And we had panels on all sorts of different topics that where we would actually look, we'd include people who had been involved in Science for the People and could give us an analysis that resonated with that movement, and then people who were working on similar issues today. So that was the goal of that conference. And we have it all archived on this website, science-for-the-people.org. And we invited people also to share their materials, which, you know, if they're in paper format, have been archived at UMass Amherst in our archives here. And some of those materials have also been scanned and put on the that same website so that it's a resource there. And so that's, you know, and then six of us from, you know, who attended that conference got together and decided that we wanted to put together a volume to collect some of these primary sources and make them available for a next generation. Do you want to add to that, Dan?
Yeah. And then, yeah, six of us started on that project, but it ended up being, and all six of us ended up contributing, but the three of us became the main editors, and that includes Alyssa Botello, who wasn't able to do the interview, but we want to give her a shout out and some recognition. But she's a PhD MD student at Harvard. Yeah, and I was and Sigrid. Yeah, so I was partially recruited by Sigrid to work on this project, and I'm glad I did.
Great. So as we get started here with the book, we have some of that discussion in the introduction about this 2014 conference. In addition, we hear a little bit about the group itself and how it went about creating you know, basically participation in these kinds of science related active political activism. So I was wondering, in terms of the group itself, could you talk a little bit about how you know, they recruited in terms of, like, for instance, the bi-monthly magazine and things like this, where they got people to be more aware of the issues, and maybe you can even talk about the disrupting of various conferences.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. Maybe it'd be helpful for your listeners if I just did answer that question with a brief overview of the organization's history. Or Science for the People is originally founded in 1969 as CESPA, Science and Engineers for Political Action.
Social and political
mm-hmm. action. And that happens at the December 1969 meeting of the American Association for Arts. I'm sorry, the American
Physical Society.
No. I was going to go back to the American Physical Society in 67. The American Association for the Advancement of Science, is when it's formed. But prior to that, 2 years earlier, 1967, at the American Physical Association Society, Charles Schwartz, who later plays a major role in Science for the People, he had passed a resolution within the APA, the American
APS.
Physical Society, to have a resolution, and you can read this in the book, the resolution that he passed, to try to get the members to make a statement. He was just trying to make it so that you could have a political statement made by the group, but because he wanted the group to have a political statement against the U.S. war in Vietnam. And it became this big controversy where people in the American Physical Society were saying, oh, science is politically neutral. We shouldn't be engaging in politics, but Schwartz was saying, well, that's not true. It is political, and to not take a stance has political ramifications, because by doing so, we're helping legitimize this brutal, awful war. So the so-called Schwartz Amendment was defeated in the efforts to pass that resolution. But that leads to this, contributes with the escalation of the war and the Black Power movement and the growth of the women's movement, a radicalization of a certain sector of scientists, many of whom also participate in March 1969 in this big walkout at MIT against Nixon's ballistic missile program, anti-ballistic missile program. And those things culminate in the foundation of this group in 1969. And so one of the major activities of Science for the People, which is a term I'm going to use because it's easier rather than CESPA, is their annual disruptions of annual meetings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which they would refer to in short as AAA dollar sign instead of an S, as their kind of way of joking, satirically associating this organization, which is the largest scientific body in the world then and now, you know, with capitalism and capitalist imperatives. So they would disrupt these meetings. These meetings were places where they could get together and organize, and they would leaflet. They would have their literature tables. They'd have alternate symposium and workshops and panels and sessions. But they would also, in some cases, disrupt sessions that they thought particularly offensive. For example, at one point, they presented Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, with the annual Dr. Strangelove Award, which is based on a 1964 Stanley Kubrick film about the arms race, and as a way of mocking him. At another point, Hubert Humphrey, who was the vice president under Lyndon Johnson, who had escalated the war in Vietnam, he was at this point, is during the Nixon administration, he's back to being a senator, but he speaks at the conference, and he's Science for the People members take over the stage, and they refuse to leave until it's agreed that they can keep all their signs that say things like "Humphrey, pimp for U.S. imperialism," surrounding him as he speaks, and then he's pelted with tomatoes and airplanes while he's speaking. So there was that kind of a thing. But there's also all kinds of other programming and movement and activism that Science for the People did. You had things like using research as activism. So, for example, the Madison Collective, expose the Army Math Research Center, which had been bombed by some leftist militants in 1970. A couple years later, they did research to expose how this center was doing computer math research that was essential to the development of weapon systems in Vietnam that were being used to crush the, you know, communist insurgency in South Vietnam. And so that's just one example of research. There was other protests and direct action against missile and weapons development firms. There was a counter-recruitment inspired partly by the war resistors and anti-draft movement, where they were trying to encourage people who were what we now call STEM workers or science workers working in weapons labs to find other employment. There was, and then later in the 70s, the group gets more involved in the environmental movement, and many participate in the big anti-nuclear movement and anti-nuke protests in Seabrook, New Hampshire, against the Seabrook nuclear power plant that's being developed there, and the largest nonviolent direct action in American history. And the group becomes a little bit also more decentralized after the late 70s. Part of it is there's some internal battles. If you really wanted to talk about that, we could. But you have people involved in food justice and agriculture, sustainability. You have people involved, again, in international solidarity work. In the 70s, it's with North Vietnam and Cuba. Later, it's in the 80s when the Reagan administration starts its counter-revolutionary wars in Central America. It's solidarity with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So I just said a bunch, and I'm sure I know I left some out. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I definitely want to say I know surviving members of Science for the People would like it clarified that officially it was not Science for the People who threw those tomatoes at Hubert Humphrey. So that they take credit for all sorts of things that they did, but they are very clear that they weren't responsible for the tomatoes. This is not at all a correction, but just to make sure that people know that the Army Math Research Center bombing. The bombing itself had nothing to do with Science for the People. You know, we know who did that, and it was not anybody affiliated with Science for the People. So, you know, when Science for the People does an expose of the Army Math Research Center in the wake of that bombing, which did in fact result in the death, accidental death of a postdoc who was in the building at the time, you know, that was a bold thing to do and a controversial thing to do because, you know, nobody, I don't think, wanted to be saying that, that death was incredibly regrettable, and it was a difficult thing for a leftist organization to come forward at that point and not defend the bombing of the AMRC. That's not what they were doing in that expose, but rather to say that, you know, even as we mourn the death of that researcher, we have to recognize that this institution, the Army Math Research Center, was directly responsible for research that was applied in Vietnam and used to kill far, far more people. And so they were not going to let that go. They weren't going to say that in the process of mourning the death of somebody who was killed because of this leftist violent action, that we should then absolve the whole institution for what in their minds really amounted to criminal military activity in Vietnam. I guess I would also just say, so on the agriculture front, and this is one of the areas where the legacy of Science for the People, I think, has been strongest. And this especially came out of the Ann Arbor chapter, where John Vandermeer then and now he continues to be extremely influential along with Yvette Perfecto in sustaining a kind of a core of leftist agricultural scientists. So those solidarity work that Dan mentioned with the Sandinistas, some of these folks were graduate students in the program at in the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, who went and spent years in some cases doing solidarity work in agricultural science, you know, ecological forms of agriculture. With the Sandinistas, they also did work domestically. So consistent with their Marxist perspective and their, you know, labor focus, they formed alliances with labor organizations, including the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which organized workers and farm workers in the Midwest. And so they would work with them on issues related to pesticides and also with the mechanization, you know, confronting the, you know, the consequences of agricultural mechanization for farm laborers. You know, it's basically a labor issue because it can displace workers.
Wait, and a couple other things, if you don't mind, Chad, because this group did so much. Another thing is you mentioned the newspaper, and they started publishing the newspaper in 1970. There's over 100 issues by the time it folded in 1989. But in some ways, the group, like I said, becomes a lot more fluid and decentralized after beginning in the early 80s. And it, as an organization, it's more the newspaper and then kind of a constellation of different people inspired by Science to the People or former members working on different campaigns locally. But one of the things that's important about this newspaper is that it kept these ideas alive and became sort of a node of networking and organizing. But it also helped promote this ongoing message, which was at the core of what Science for the People was about, which is their assertion that science is never politically neutral. And they, you know, whether they were doing direct action or whether they were trying to do solidarity work or help the Black Panthers set up medical clinics or computer software, they're doing it with this idea that science is always political, and we want a science that works for the advancement of human freedom and dignity and justice, rather and for environmental sustainability, rather than for militarism and capitalist exploitation. So, yeah.
In a nutshell, that's what the organization was about. There's a lot to say.
Yeah. Yeah, and also challenging genetic engineering, challenging scientific racism and biological determinism, scientific justifications for gender inequality and homophobia or anti-gay, anti-queer ideas and policies. And also members played a critical role in probably one of the most important movements of the 1980s, which is a successful movement to stop the Reagan administration's Strategic Defense Initiative, also known as the Star Wars Missile Defense Program, which was at the time the largest military project in American history.
Yeah. So my question was more about the promotion and recruitment elements of the group, but as this was a great overview of everything that they'd done. And so obviously these kinds of actions were the ways in which they, you know, recruited throughout their and promoted throughout their existence. So on that, sorry.
I mean, you know, when you're so looking at like what, you know, brought people in, you know, so they're organizing on college campuses, right, for the most part. And so there are a lot of people who, you know, come to it because they are, you know, members of these campus communities, and they become, you know, involved through that kind of networking. But then more broadly, the magazine acts as a, you know, a very important point of entry. And I think a lot of people, you know, as we were doing researching the book, one question that we were asked periodically is, you know, how are you defining a member of Science for the People? And I think the very fact that that is a difficult question to answer speaks to some of the organizational structure, because frankly, you know, people, when we were having the conference, would identify themselves as former members of the organization who, you know, really had just been subscribers to the magazine. But for them, you know, that was, you know, they felt connected to this movement because they were supporting the magazine through their subscription, because they were reading it, you know, potentially they were also contributing to it. But that, you know, that involvement in and of itself was an important way for people to feel connected to this movement, and people who now to this day feel connected to the movement, such that when the call went out for the conference, they signed up. And now that the organization has actually been revitalized, and there are, you know, people who, you know, whose connection to the organization was via the magazine, who are now moved to, you know, to participate.
And they also did a lot of recruiting, you know, through the AAAS meetings and conferences, and with their counter recruitment mm-hmm. efforts, and in anti-war movement networks and other leftist networks.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of what's unique about this movement, could you speak a little bit more about their interventions in terms of their intellectual sort of point of view here when it comes to an ideological critique of science? So in the first chapter, we have a number of documents, you know, ranging from the 1970s to most recently in 2014. So could you speak a little bit about maybe the consistency of their critique and you know, some of the different elements of their critique of mainstream science?
Sure. So one of the things, and one of the reasons that, you know, this organization spoke so compellingly to me is that, you know, so, you know, I'm a historian who studies science and politics. And so I, you know, I'm kind of bridging history and science. These were folks, some of the people involved in Science for the People were historians or social scientists. And many of them, most of them were natural scientists, some of whom had an extraordinary capacity to understand history and politics. And that is, you know, increasingly rare. I would say it was rare even in the 1970s. These were folks, Dick Levins, Dick Lewontin, Stephen Jay Gould, Rita Arditi, many others, Jonathan Beck. I mean, I could go on and on, but Ruth Hubbard, another great example. These are people who were steeped in political analysis. They and especially in the political analysis that comes out of the Marxist tradition. So these were people who had read their Marxist history and political philosophy and were able to apply it very thoughtfully in a very deep and rich manner to the politics of science in their own day. They drew in particular from the writings of British Marxist scientists from the interwar period, people like Bernal and Haldane and Hogben, people, Needham, people who themselves identified as Marxists, who drew on understandings of political economy to analyze, you know, where science and politics were going at that point. And the 1970s was quite different. It was a different historical moment, to be sure. So the analysis was going to change because of those differences. So, for example, the especially people like J.D. Bernal in the early 20th century England, you know, was very enamored of the way that the Soviet Union had organized science and was really advocating for the development of kind of a big state-sponsored science system of the kind that the Soviet Union had accomplished, and thought that that was really the kind of the big solution to the problem. The folks in the 1970s, you know, by that point, the U.S. had actually produced big science here in the U.S. And, you know, state-supported science was a thing, but it was in a capitalist context. And so the emphasis shifted, you know, somewhat, and it was no longer about how to produce a big state science that had, you know, produced big state science, but rather a critique of the state corporate scientific axis, and to you know, question how big science had come to serve capitalism and imperialism rather than serve the public interest as those early 20th century Marxist scientists had envisioned. Another kind of major important difference was the way in which race and gender came to, you know, be recognized as very important kinds of oppression and axes for analysis. So they were not necessarily always successful in, you know, figuring out how to prioritize race and gender to the same extent as looking at class oppression under capitalism. And there we talk somewhat in the book, especially about the feminists in the Science for the People movement, who have expressed considerable frustration about the limits to which they were able to pursue a feminist critique of science within Science for the People. So there were gaps, but these were definitely subjects that were on the table, and that many of the members of Science for the People were explicitly and passionately committed to. But I think, you know, Dan, you know, the kind of the overarching point, Dan already expressed and put it really well, that this is really about the impossibility of seeing science as in any way politically neutral. And they come back to this over and over again. And no matter what subject they're looking at, whether, you know, it's agriculture, whether it's, you know, racism in biology, whether it's, you know, computers, you name it, when it comes down to it, the crux of the analysis, it's about power. It's about seeing how, you know, that without an analysis of power, you don't understand why science isn't working. And so if it's about technology, it's not that technology is good or bad. It's that technology serves the people in power, and that if you want technology to serve the people, you've got to pursue a revolutionary politics that puts the people in power. And you can't expect technology to serve the people unless you have a revolutionary politics. And that will be true with agriculture. If you're wondering why chemical corporations, you know, or why why we have we use so many pesticides, it's not simply, you know, a matter of people trying to kill the bugs in their garden, right? You have to understand the political power and the economic power of chemical corporations and how that influenced the direction that research into insects took in this country. So it always comes back to power, and that's really at the root of it. And that's, you know, what they got from their Marxist predecessors, and, you know, what continues to inform the movement today.
Can I add something to that? I just a couple of things that I think why Science for the People is important or cool or inspiring, even though as historians and, you know, just critical thinkers, we can't just romanticize them and not recognize their limits, but I still do find a lot of inspiration from them. And one of them is the fact that, you know, there's the myth of science as politically neutral is so heavy that, you know, just the idea of science as political activists and radical political activists, it's just interesting. And I think for those, most of your listeners are probably, if not scientists or STEM workers, then people who are in the field of STS. But I think it's encouraging for them or listeners to know, if you're a scientist or a STEM worker, you can be politically active, and you can be politically active in your own field and in your own place of work. And I think that's where often we can be most effective in political activism. And it's actually partly why Sigrid is more involved in the current Science for the People than I am. I've helped write this book and I'm happy to help guide with historical insights, but because it's not my main area of focus, my political activity I've focused in a little bit in other places. But I think keeping that in mind, that wherever we're at, wherever our job is, wherever our field of work or whatever our community is, there's a way to be politically active and to critique power and to challenge power in collective efforts with others and in solidarity with people in other locations. So that's another thing I would take away from this.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to their critique of science, they also oftentimes they develop alternatives, right? So whether that's Stephen Rose talking about a more relational approach to science and especially biology, to other alternatives to various kinds of research, right? So including the ideas around nuclear conversion plants and the People's Math Research Center. So could you talk a little bit about some of these alternative thoughts and actions that they had? So because they definitely have some articles in here where it is primarily a critique of mainstream science for its use in capitalism. But they also sometimes develop these and organize around these alternatives. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll start out with that. I want to, this is probably as good a time as any to emphasize the inspiration that Science for the People itself took from other movements that were happening at the same time. For example, the health clinics, the people's health clinics that the Black Panthers had set up were a major inspiration and movement that Science for the People very much wanted to support and also to draw, to recognize as a kind of leading force, as a way of saying, okay, so the system is broken. What do we do? Of course, we advocate to, transform the system. But in the meantime, people are hurting, people are dying. We also need to be creating the alternatives on the ground. And for the Black Panthers, that was about creating the community. Free community clinics where people of color, in particular Black people in communities that were often far away from hospitals, and in any case, if they could get to the hospitals, they were not confident that they could get appropriate care from people who didn't, understand the needs of their community or who were, blatantly racist. And so they formed, an alternative network of clinics across the country. So that, that's an example of the kind of inspiration they took. In, the closest thing that you could call, to a manifesto of Science for the People, and this is actually document 1.1 in the book, a document called Toward a Science for the People. The version that we have here was published in 1972, although the origins, the kind of first draft of the document was more like 1970. But in that, they do this thing, the very thing that you're saying, Chad, they don't just offer the critique, but they end it with, okay, well, what would a Science for the People look like? What should we do? And they have a list here of six different ways in which scientists can actually do their work differently. One would be technical assistance to movement organizations and oppressed people. So this included direct assistance, for example, to the Black Panthers and the Young Lords and the, Farm Labor Organizing Committee. Number two, foreign technical help to revolutionary movements. So that included their work helping revolutionary movements in Vietnam, in Nicaragua, Cuba, Number three, people's research. This they say, quote, unlike the technical assistance projects described above, these are areas in which scientists should take the initiative and begin developing projects that will aid struggles that are just beginning to develop. For example, workers in the medical and social sciences and in education could help design a program for client-controlled daycare centers, which would both free women from the necessity of continual childcare and provide a thoroughly socialist educational experience for the children. Number four, exposés and power structure research. That's, you know, what Dan was talking about before with the Army Math Research Center. They also did a very influential expose on the JASON group, the secretive group of scientists that the government hired to advise them on military matters. Number five is ideological struggle. So this is basically the creation of the magazine would count here. Also, they made numerous curricula, school curricula. We have one example in the book of from the what they call the Feed, Need, Greed school curriculum on agriculture and what we would today call food justice. Number six is the demystification of science and technology. This is, you know, what today some people might call science communication, right? So actually trying to explain scientific ideas and, you know, the content of science to the general public. However, unlike a lot of the folks who are involved in science communication today, they saw this explicitly in political terms. And that's why they use this term demystification, which is, you know, a term that Marxists commonly use to indicate that it's not just about explaining concepts, but actively subverting the way in which the power structure keeps people ignorant of the knowledge that they need in order to liberate themselves.
Yeah, and that's one of, you mentioned, Chad, and so did Sigrid, the alternative Army Math Research Center. They called for a People's Math Research Center. They wrote this large book, you know, that about three quarters of the book was analyzing, exposing, critiquing the research used by the AMRC. But then at the end, and we have some of it excerpted in our book, they outline this People's Math Research Center and how it would be funded. And a big part of it was saying, like, we need to demystify this science and make this center available to all these different movement organizations and community organizations who could use it for their own projects. And they even went so far as to talk about how they would try to get the funding for that. Similarly, there was also this movement in the 80s that some Science for the People were members of that was seeking to convert the U.S. nuclear laboratories in Livermore, California, and Los Alamos, Mexico, into some other sort of research center that would have similar purposes, you know, being used for the people and research or being used for development of human welfare rather than militarism.
You've already touched up on this, but a number of these chapters also discuss these attempts to integrate not just scientists, regarding these kind of politics, but also getting non-experts involved, and you know, whether it's talking about a kind of participatory technology or research, as you mentioned. So I was wondering if you could talk about some of those cases.
Well, I know one was there was a technical assistance program in that the Boston Science for the People chapter was involved with, and they were trying to set up radio and communication and other technology support for the Black Panthers and other local organizations. And they had a vision of expanding it further. Some of the limitations were that this was a small collective of people mostly working, volunteering in their free time. And sometimes they had challenges. Their goal was to teach other people how to do this technology themselves, but often it ended up being a free repair or technology advice service, and they weren't able to move beyond that with their limited resources. But that's one example. Also in Nicaragua, there was several different teams of people, including from the New World Agricultural Group in Ann Arbor, who went down and worked with researchers and farmers in Nicaragua to develop sustainable agricultural practices and develop agricultural education, with a focus also on women, young women in Nicaragua, providing them or helping them gain access to that education. So those are some of the examples, but I think that there was limits to how much of that they were able to do.
I think, you know, here, two things. One is, you know, connects with my own original interest in Science for the People, is how much inspiration they took from what they saw in China when their delegation went to China. So in China, during this period, you have this phenomenon known as mass science, and it's really all about overcoming this division between expert professional knowledge and the kind of knowledge that working people have through their experience in whether it's factory work or farm work or whatever their experience through their own labor is. And so they called this, you know, mass science, the idea that people who were not professional scientists had something real to contribute to scientific knowledge. The temptation today, I think, you know, would be to connect this with this thing we've come to call citizen science, right? Where there's an interest in encouraging lay people to get involved in participating in scientific research in different ways. But I think there are a couple of distinctions that are really important to keep in mind. One is, again, the political. Today, this phenomenon we call citizen science can be and has been mobilized, you know, as much to support science that is in fact profiting companies as it is necessarily to support people's needs. And where it has served people's needs the best, I would argue it's where scientists are collaborating with grassroots organizations. So it's not just about kind of mobilizing, you know, people kind of, you know, just out there, you know, loosely. It's about creating active solidarity with organizations on the ground. And a really good example of this would be the work of the Pesticide Action Network, which also has has its origins in a connection with Science for the People. I don't think it would be fair to say it actually emerged from Science for the People, but there's overlaps in the people, and there was some inspiration there. Margaret Reeves is somebody who was active in the original Science for the People, who now works for Pesticide Action Network and is also involved in the revitalization of Science for the People today. She was at the first national convention of the new Science for the People that was just held in February, actually at Ann Arbor. And she emphasized that in their work, they make it a rule that they, they provide scientific expertise and, support to people who are, concerned about pesticides in their communities. But, you know, the rule is that, you know, they've got to work with an organization that's working at the grassroots to do this and that has a policy goal in mind. So this, you know, this idea of kind of participation, of getting lay people involved, is really important. And it definitely was a very, you know, important part of the vision of Science for the People. It's also kind of science by the people, but not in a kind of depoliticized sense that citizen science often is. Not always, but often is. It is about solidarity with the organizations that are working in communities and understand what those communities need and have legitimacy within those communities.
That's a very important distinction. So thinking about some of these actions in the past that have led to maybe some of these folks starting other organizations. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, the legacy of Science for the People, and a little bit more in depth about how it's influencing this, revitalization.
Yeah, so Science for the People, the people of Science for the People didn't go away. The organization itself folded in part because of tax problems, very mundane reasons, but also, some of the energy had kind of moved in other directions. But the people involved went on to continue to do science for the people, to do literally science for the people, so whether that means, working among Maasai people in Africa to develop appropriate water and energy technologies, which Bob Lange of the original Science for the People does, or working in occupational health and safety. That's a major area where people originally in Science for the People have continued to do very important work. Pesticides, I already mentioned, and other kinds of environmental work, medical equity, health equity, these areas. So many different areas that, people continued to do this, to put their energy into. The current revitalization of Science for the People, again, we just had the first of the revitalized, the first National Convention of the Revitalized Science for the People in February. The organizing around that has been going on for several years, but got a real boost after Trump's election and with the first March for Science in 2017, mainly because I think a lot of people felt that on one hand, we absolutely want to march for science. On the other hand, we don't want to march for some kind of science in the abstract, right? Like we're marching for science for the people, not science for the Pentagon, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to make that clear and make that point clear. The second March for Science just happened last weekend, and Science for the People was out in force many of the major centers. There are now chapters in quite a few places, including New York, Atlanta, Ann Arbor, here in Western Mass. There are a number of other chapters, and we have working groups on militarism, on nuclear disarmament, on sociobiology, on labor organizing, on Puerto Rico, and on education, on climate change, on reproductive justice, and a number of other issues. And several of the chapters, including our own here in Western Mass, are very committed to forging solidarities with grassroots organizations to address the issues that they are facing in the communities that they are organizing, and figure out ways that we can put scientists in the service of the issues that they've identified as most important to their communities.
Well, we're just about out of time here. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you both what projects are you working on now? I mean, Sigrid, you just mentioned some of the activities around Science for the People right now, but in terms of your current scholarly work, could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I admit that I'm spending a lot of time on Science for the People, and I am thinking about it as a hybrid of scholarly and activist work. I'm also working to launch a book series with UMass Press called Activist Science and Technology Studies. So that is just in formation now, but we are looking for book manuscripts that will, help science and technology studies reclaim these radical activist roots and kind of build on the important legacies of that that important cross-fertilization between science for the people and science and technology studies. On the China side, I'm continuing to work on agriculture. My recent work was on, my book was called Red Revolution, Green Revolution, on scientific farming in socialist era China. And now I'm working on agricultural terraces and the kind of significance of terracing campaigns in the Mao era and the way in which they formed an important foundation for the conservation and heritage, agricultural heritage work in more recent times around agricultural terracing in China.
And my research is not on terraces, but on terrorism. So I'm writing a book. I'm finishing up a manuscript for a book. It's called Nixon's War on Terrorism. The FBI, leftist guerrillas, and the origins of counterterrorism, and it's with the post the Power Politics and Society series at the University of North Carolina Press, and it's looking at how violence that came out of the movements of the U.S. left in the late 60s and early 70s, groups like the Weather Underground and the Black Liberation Army, and like the bombers at the in Madison at the Army Math Research Center, how that's looking partly how where that violence came from in terms of being motivated as a response to state violence, but then how that violence in turn influences the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and its surveillance and counterintelligence practices, and politics more broadly during the Nixon administration, and looking at how this conflict between the FBI and the Nixon administration and this leftist guerrillas contributes to the emergence of counterterrorism. So, and efforts to revive also, and efforts to revive a earlier Cold War surveillance state in the name of fighting terrorism. So it has ramifications also for our post 9/11 era, where we do have a revitalization of a surveillance state and counterterrorism that's even being directed at movements like Black Lives Matter and the anti-pipeline indigenous protesters in the Dakotas, and et cetera.
Well, those sound like very interesting projects. I hope that when your book comes out that you consider, joining one of our New Books Network podcasts for an interview. To wrap up for today, I wanted to thank our guests, Sigrid and Dan, and their book, again, is Science for the People, Documents from America's Movement of Radical Scientists, edited by Sigrid Schmalzer, Daniel Chard, and Alyssa Botello, with contributions from Thomas Connor, Colin Garvey, and Ben Allen, along with really well over a dozen contributions from various Science for the People members. Thank you again. I really enjoy it. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.